mouthful of honey.
I can open it. <All right. laughs>
Oh my goodness. All right, good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, your Subcommittee on General Government. Today's February 10th. We've got a big agenda today. What I'm going to do, colleagues, because we have folks who are going to be coming and going, is I'm actually going to open up everything, okay? And then as folks have to go testify on bills, they'll come and go. And then what I'm going to ask, though, as we get towards the end of the day, the end of our hearing, if everyone can make sure they're back. And at that point in time, we'll take action on all the work session items. Is that okay?
Yes.
That is wisdom from Mr. Bender. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm going to open up the informational meeting on the Secretary of State or STAR project. I'm going to open up the informational meeting on the Department of Administrative Services Senate Bill 55 project. I'm actually going to open up the work sessions on Department of Revenue collection budget note reports on the state reciprocal program, debt write-off. Are we doing those all separate, or is that just one work session?
Those are separate.
All right, so we're going to open up a work session on the state reciprocal program, a work session on the debt write-offs and cancellations, a work session on the audit case selection, and a work session on cash management. Okay, so again, colleagues, what my intention is to run through all the informational portion of these meetings, and then at the end of the agenda, at the end of the hearing, we'll do all of our votes. All righty? Okay, so I'm going to ask for Robert Taylor and Jim Williams to come up. We're going to start off on the ORSTAR project. And Mr. Bender, what do we need to know about this?
Mr. Co-Chair and subcommittee members, the Secretary of State has submitted a request for $347,900 in general fund and establishment of one limited duration position for the purposes of procuring a new election night reporting system, which would be replace an existing module of the ORSTAR system, which is one of the primary IT systems operated by the Elections Division. They are going to be presenting this request to you. The co-chairs have asked that you not take a vote on this at this time, that you receive this information and let them know if you have any concerns about the request. The request was previously brought before the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, who recommended approving the request if it is funded, with some recommendations to the Secretary of State in terms of reporting back to the legislature. That is also included in our analysis if you have any questions. But otherwise, they will be presenting to you their request for funding to replace their election night reporting system.
Perfect. So, gentlemen, I'm going to give you 10 minutes, and I'm going to hold tight to 10 minutes. If for some reason, colleagues, we need more time, you'll let me know, and we'll get it rescheduled for more time. But I want to get through our agenda today. So welcome. The floor is yours.
Would you like to introduce yourself? My name is Jim Williams, Director of the Elections Division for the Secretary of State's office.
I'm Robert Taylor, the Deputy Secretary of State, and Jim Williams is going to run the presentation and get us in and out on time.
Perfect.
Yes. Thank you. Chair Representative Smith, Chair Senator Steiner, Hayward, members of the committee, we're here to talk about ORSTAR upgrades in general, specifically election night reporting system, as was mentioned. And even more specifically, this would be in regards to our policy option package 202 from 2015, when we reported and promised to be back during February to clarify some things. A little background for ORSTAR very quickly. It began in 2007 with just two modules, and now, 9 years later, grown with several more modules that have been added over the years. Given the current election cycle, maintaining and updating ORSTAR requires both a short-term plan and a long-term plan. The short-term plan is what we addressed with the committee and legislature last year. Joint Ways and Means allocated $285,000 for our short-term plan to address improvements and bug fixes. The long-term plan is more of a goal of 2018 to have a path toward an upgraded ORSTAR and more functionality and better for the users. I want to talk more about the long-term plan. first of all, talk about what has been completed. We had a complete assessment of the ORSTAR system by a consultant over 8 to 9 months last year during 2015. We got the final report in December, and that report has been distributed to LFO staff and is available if you'd like to see it. One of the things that the consultant did in that final report is to identify certain modules that could be maintained in-house and identify modules that could be replaced with some off-the-shelf software by vendors.
Senator Johnson, we have a question.
Thank you. I appreciate the fact that you've added modules over time. You've had a consultant come in and do a report. You want to do more stuff. I want to know about the on-time performance. I want to know, did the consultant track the number of times that some of us try to access a system and you're down? What's your performance record? Because it's fine to add stuff and buy stuff and do stuff, but I want to know, what's your performance record in terms of security, in terms of availability, in terms of downtime, in terms of length of downtime? How's the system performing? Because you're asking us to give you more money to do more stuff. And in fairness, you came and talked to me, and I think you made your case. But I also think that it is valuable to build a record about how is this thing performing.
Right. Co-Chair Senator Johnson, you're absolutely correct. Evaluation by the consultant was more big picture, looking at things, ways that perhaps we could take some modules away so that we could focus on the core functions of things that are so Oregon-specific, specifically campaign finance reporting and some of the things that are commonly used, that ORSTAR is commonly used for. We have some reports that we didn't, this evaluation by the consultant did not get into a lot of those details. We do have some of those reports available, and we could get those through our tracking system in-house. I do have with us today our ISD director, who may be able to report more regarding downtime and system availability and those kinds of
things. Mr. Chair, I'll let this line of questioning go if I can have the assurance that instead of sending me an 88-page report, you know, it's like handing somebody a shovel and saying, I know there's a pony in there somewhere, I distill out. How are you doing? Are you up more than you're down? How long are you down? What's the longest downtime? What are the vulnerabilities? We're putting all kinds of data in there, and at least anecdotally, there's been a little bit of a spotty performance. So do the analysis at an executive level for us. Don't inundate us with reports.
Co-Chair Senator Johnson, yes, I understand.
Thank and then you. I'll let it go, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. If you would just get that to Mr. Bender, Mr. Bender will get that to all of us.
Okay, I sure will. Perfect. With that in mind, to kind of put this in perspective as well, I'll say that the consultant's report was kind of a starting point for the long-term vision. With the idea of getting rid of some of the current modules that are in the system, it allows us time and resources to focus then on some of the more specific other modules that we have. So to continue the slide, in process now, we're here presenting and asking for some additional funds so that in 2016 and 2017, we can fully implement all of the recommendations. Here is a very brief chart basically showing a big overview of the consultant's findings. Basically, as you can see, several elements of ORSTAR recommended to stay in-house and be maintained as it currently is, but there are some recommend replacing. I would add to this particular slide that the UOCAVA element that's mentioned, it's under the column to replace with a vendor. That is an element of my vote that is already being fulfilled by an outside
Mr.
vendor,
Chair.
But that we want to continue to explore other possible options.
For those of us that do not speak fluent Secretary of State, what is UOCAVA?
UOCAVA actually stands for the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens of America Voting Act. And so basically what this refers to is our method of ballot delivery system to overseas citizens.
Thank you.
And so a couple of elements that recommended that we check on outside sources, and we're here specifically talking about election night reporting. That was one of the first modules that the consultant identified as having some off-the-shelf software available. We wanted to point out that we were responsive to our budget subcommittee. Several members of the committee expressed concern about the election night reporting system as it currently exists, and it was pointed out to us that results are not presented consistently and are not easily understandable.
Mr. Chair, I can't help myself.
We
talked in my office when you all came up to see me that you guys can have the slickest computer system on the planet, but if you don't get the data from the counties, timeliness goes out the window. And so I'm trying to figure out, how do you inculcate in your clerks that are responsible for collating the local data and getting it to you, how do you instill a sense of urgency that you're now asking the legislature to spend six figures so that you guys can shine on election night, but you're only as good as the data you get? What's the plan to get everybody motivated to get that info in quickly? And then one other thing, I'd love to know how you calibrate how well you do with UOKava to make sure that some soldier in Afghanistan's getting their ballot. But that's another time for another conversation for another time.
Right. Co-Chair Senator Johnson, you're exactly right. And I think the first step of instilling that the significance of this to the counties is appearances like this, appearing with the legislators and all of us working together to let them know. We had a couple of slides where we pointed out some comments that have come out from legislators, including that the current system is a mess, that it's opaque, and that we need some standardized reporting. I think while we want to be mindful of our committee members, it's also important that I want to point out that we're very responsive and very concerned about increasing the value to the public. Mm-hmm. We think it's very – the election night reporting is something that is perhaps the most visible aspect of what we do in election administration, and that is part of implementing this new system. We're going to make sure that we give the counties some training and instill in them the importance of maintaining some consistency in their reporting.
So really quick, colleagues, I want to turn to you on this. Rep. Comp's not here, but Senator Whitson and co-chair, both of you shared some statements here. What am I missing on this? When I look at election night results, to me it's pretty simple. What am I missing?
Senator?
I'm pleased that you have good reporting in your area. We don't, and it's.
I want to go back.
A lot of people don't know how the election came out until the next day.
Can I go back to Senator Johnson? Is that training at the more of the county level then?
If I may respond, I think it's both training and equipment. In some counties, they're probably still doing this with stone tablets. And so I don't know whether you've done a comprehensive inventory, and I know that all the clerks are independently elected folks, but I don't know to what degree they understand they're part of the whole. And do you have a inventory of what each county needs in order to be successful?
Mm-hmm. Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, the conversation we're having right now and the frank demands of the legislature about the needs for consistency and uniformity among the counties, that's the kind of feedback we need to get from you, because we take that back to our counties and we have that type of candid conversation with those elected clerks. And part of what we're trying to do with this election night reporting system is, if every county has its own website and is free to post its results whenever they want, we don't have a good platform to drive them towards consistency.
That's the status as I know it right now.
That is the status right now. So what part of what this does is helps centralize the reporting for all the elections in the state and gives us and the citizens, more importantly, a platform to see that. And it will not happen overnight that counties all post results as soon as we would like. That will take time. It will take time to get them all there.
Okay.
But first we have to build this platform and then help bring them all along.
So let's do this. Can you just take 90 seconds and wrap up for this informational meeting?
Sure. Absolutely. Speaker. So what we're here asking for, $300,000 for the system for this biennium, $49,500 for a limited duration project manager. Basically, an overview of what the current system does, the limitations. It only tracks current statewide offices and races, no customized views or searches. The new solution tracks all races, precinct-level reporting. You can follow select races on the screen without having to scroll, so a lot of benefits. And then lastly, we provide a couple of screenshots of what the new system, in its early stages, that we imagine it will look like.
Perfect. All right.
Thank you for your time.
Excellent job in getting that done. Madam Co-Chair?
Just as an FYI, we also heard a very identical presentation in the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology. I can never remember the name of the committee I'm on because it's so long. And that committee also dove into this in some detail. So I think we're hearing loud and clear, and we appreciate it. And by the way, if anybody out there in citizen land wonders whether what we're saying is really recorded, the fact that there were exact quotes from three of us from this subcommittee from almost exactly a year ago should point out the value of having our system recorded and up online, because everybody should have the right to know what we're saying in committee meetings. So thank you for demonstrating that point so ably, Mr. Williams.
Perfect. Thank you very thank much you. For coming and sharing this information. I'm sure we'll be talking about it a little bit more here very soon.
Great.
Thank you. Okay. I'm able to close that informational meeting. Yep. Okay. I'm going to close that the informational meeting on Secretary of State or STAR project. Our informational meeting on Department of Administrative Services, Senate Bill 55, is already open, so we're going to ask you folks to come on up. Why don't you give us an overview of what we're going to discuss?
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Department of Administrative Services is here to discuss implementation of Senate Bill 55 related to debt collection.
And really quick, Paul, how much time do you think we should allocate for this? How much time do you think we need?
Well, I think, George, like 30, 40 minutes.
So we're going to give you 10 minutes. I'm going to hold you to a tight 10 minutes if we could.
Mr. Chair, it shouldn't take very long. Okay. So for members of the committee, George Naughton, Chief Financial Officer of the State, Acting Chief Operating Officer. During the 2015 session, there was a bill, Senate Bill 55, that was passed that really was aimed at helping encourage the state to increase our debt collection ability on delinquent accounts. For a little bit of background, Department of Administrative Services used to have some people inside the agency that helped coordinate agencies to do a good job at this. When we went into the 2008 recession, those positions were cut as one of the budget cuts that went through the process, like several different things were, and we chose not to really aggressively go after some of these delinquent accounts, partly because it was a time when businesses and individuals were really struggling. We decided it was not a good time to go after that. When Senate Bill 55 was brought forward during the last legislative session, we very much agreed that this was a good thing to stand back up. And the purpose of Senate Bill 55 puts responsibility on the agencies to up that game and gives DAS a central coordinating role to provide training, technical assistance, and do a management report. As part of that, in the General Government Subcommittee, when the bill came through here, you added three positions to the Department of Administrative Services inside the Chief Financial Office. The positions were to start in October 1st of 2000.
They were for a full biennium.
Okay, for a full biennium. When we actually got the budget passed through, the three positions will be inside of what is our unit that also puts together the statewide annual financial report, which is a six-month heavy-duty period of work. And Mr. Hamilton's with me. Rob Hamilton is the manager of that unit. We decided that we were not going to fill those positions in the middle of that CAFR season because it was a workload issue, and Rob needed to be part of that group, but also we needed to get the CAFR out the door. While we were getting ready for that, we got the position descriptions ready so we could launch the positions as soon as we got done, which was in early January. Positions closed yesterday, I believe, and we're hoping we'll have those positions filled pretty quickly. But we didn't wait while we had the positions coming forward to actually get started on the work. So what Rob is going to cover for you is really basically three things, actually four things. The first is give you a highlight of some of the training we've already done. The second is to talk about the administrative rule that we've started working on already. Third, we've started a pilot project with Department of Transportation, Department of Revenue, and DAS on how to share information back and forth. And then finally, the next steps we're going to do once the positions come on board. So with that, I will turn it over to Rob Hamilton, and let Rob walk you through those different components.
Perfect. Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Rob Hamilton. I'm the manager of the Statewide Accounting Reporting Services Unit, which is within the Chief Financial Office at DAS. Like George mentioned, a couple of things that we've been working on this past year as we implement a statewide accounts receivable management process. There was a training that occurred last year that was 3 hours. It was attended by 115 people from 31 agencies. The training focused on collections, assigning liquidated and delinquent accounts receivables to the other agency accounts at the Department of Revenue or to a private collection firm, and writing off bad debt. As far as the administrative rule on Social Security numbers, we've been working on that since the fall. That rule is to provide clarity to agencies so they know when that they can ask a person to voluntarily provide his or her Social Security number to a state agency for the debt collection purposes, and to notify them that it will be used for debt collection purposes. Then with the vendor offset pilot program that George mentioned that's going on between the Department of Revenue, Department of Transportation, and DAS, so far, the Department of Revenue has received 24,000 records from the Department of Transportation, their vendor file, and they've matched 5,600 individual taxpayer records. Of those taxpayer records, 545 were individuals and 5,053 were businesses. They used.
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
I am very familiar with Senate Bill 55, but tell me what ODOT is. They've sent you 24,000 records. You've matched basically a quarter of them, for the sake of conversation.
Yeah, 50. Yeah.
What is that telling you?
Right now, it just tells us that there are vendors that do owe the state of Oregon for some sort of liquidated and delinquent debt. Chair Smith.
Some subset of the 5,000, or are all 5,000 in arrearages?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, 5,000 unique taxpayers. Of that portion, 5% of the businesses were in arrears and 8% of the individuals were in arrears.
Of the 5,000 that you've matched to date.
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Sorry.
At this point, all we've been able to identify is that there are vendors that do owe the state of Oregon debt. The next step of the process is to examine the characteristics of that debt. Is there a payment plan? Are they in bankruptcy? Part of the other next step of this process is to develop a standard schema so that there is a standard communication between agencies to transmit this data, because not all state agencies use the accounting system in the same manner.
Yep.
One more. How burdensome has it been to do this match at this point?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, Deanna Mack from the Department of Revenue is available, and she had mentioned that she could provide a little bit more detail on that specific question. I don't know. I haven't been involved with it.
It's germane to the next question that I'm going to ask, which is there is a companion bill, maybe that's the wrong terminology, but there's another bill this session that is going to start asking banks to match to various accounts to announce that Betsy Johnson has an account with XYZ Bank. The banks are saying that this is incredibly burdensome, and I'm trying to understand, out of the 24,000 records, the 5,000 you've sorted, how burdensome has it been? And if Ms. Mack has insight into that, I'd welcome hearing it.
Here, you stay.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And right now, the file that we originally got from ODOT was 100 vendors. It was a sample, and it was not a good sample because no one was a debtor. So we expanded it to a list of all vendors, and they sent us 24,000 records. And the matching was a little difficult because the way that the ODOT had their records was the business name was all in one. Like first name, last name was all in one field, and our system has first name, last name in different fields. So a lot of the records were duplicative. That's why we only matched 5,600 total records of the 24,000, because the remainder were vendors that were duplicative. So they had more than one contract, more than one payment, something along those lines.
Let me stop while you're taking a breath. So you stopped now. I got the impression this was work in progress, that you're still sifting through the 24,000 records that came from ODOT. Have you reached a terminus?
Mr. Chair and Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, we are still working on the project. We have finished the match and identified how many vendors were also in our system as taxpayers and how many of those were debtors. And like Mr. Hamilton said, I think for personal income tax, it was less than 8% of them were debtors and less than 5% for business taxes. And so what we're doing now is looking at what does that debt make up? Anyone who had over $25 of debt was the part of the match. So it could be, does it make sense to offset their payment if they only owe us $50? Does it make sense to offset their payment if they're in a payment plan? We can't offset their payment if they're in bankruptcy. It's against the law. So those are the kind of characteristics that he's talking about that we need to figure out. And then we also need to standardize the data that's transmitted between the agencies, because we know what we need in order to do a match against our debtor records. So we need separate fields. And every agency kind of keeps their records in different formats, depending on whether they use SFMA or whether they interface with SFMA. So that's why DAS is one of the partners and ODOT is one of the partners, because obviously DAS uses SFMA and the DOR and ODOT do not. We interface with it. So we need to standardize the schema for both of those paths, and then other agencies can come on board with vendor offset.
Thank you.
Okay, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mack, you may not be able to answer this question, and I want to put on the record, for the record, for anybody who's curious, it's House Bill 4131, and it has passed out of the House Policy Committee, has been referred to Ways and Means because there is a fiscal. I think it plausible that it will come to this subcommittee, so we'll have another opportunity to talk about it. I mean, assuming that it moves, it will likely come to this subcommittee, because I can't think of another one where it would go. But Ms. Mack, my understanding in reference to Senator Johnson's question is that DOJ, Child Support Division, already, this is the part you may not be able to answer, but already works with banks to do that matching. And they already have a system in place, the banks do, for doing the matching. So I've been a little puzzled, and maybe Senator Johnson can fill us in, and maybe we should hold this till then we actually have the hearing on that bill. But I've been a little puzzled why they think it's going to be onerous to do it.
That's my question.
Right, I don't understand that piece, because I see your point about DAS and ODOT or DOR and ODOT having different systems, mm-hmm. but if the banks already have what's going on.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, I've been working closely with Representative Taylor on that bill, yes. House Bill 4131. It was part of our presentation I was planning to mention later. The idea with that particular bill is that we would send the debtor's name and Social Security number to the financial institution, and the financial institution would come back and tell us yes, they have an account, or no, they do not have an account. There's an amendment that I believe -6 amendment for that bill that will take out any other data exchange. It's literally just a positive or negative result. Yes, we have an account with this person, this debtor has an account with XYZ Bank, or not. So it allows us to be more efficient in how we issue garnishments to the agencies or to the different financial institutions. Because right now we issue blanket garnishments, hoping, guessing, fishing for an account. This will make us smarter in our work.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, you're right.
So where we're at right now, a couple of obstacles that we've encountered. One of the things we know is certain agencies already have the ability to collect Social Security numbers from constituents. We have to develop a scheme to notify those individuals that we may be using their Social Security numbers for debt collection practices. Right now, I'd like to talk a little bit about our plan for the next 6 months for these positions when they come on board very shortly. Within the first 30 days, these positions will get an understanding of the lay of the land from an accounts receivable perspective at state agencies, including some of the obstacles that have been identified in the pilot program. They will review the Secretary of State audit report that was issued last September and plan the implementation of those recommendations as appropriate. They will participate in the continued development of the administrative rule on Social Security number collection and notification. Within the first 90 days, these positions will submit that administrative rule to Secretary of State in the next step in the administrative rulemaking process. They'll formally reconvene the Accounts Receivable Core Committee, which has been a valuable venue for accounts receivable professionals throughout state government to share best practices and concerns, and they'll examine state agency accounts receivable practices and develop a plan around accounts receivable management. Within the first 180 days, these positions will identify and track key trend information and they will develop the content and structure of the annual management report that will be submitted to the legislature in conjunction with the LFO report on liquidated and delinquent accounts receivable. And that concludes my testimony.
So, Mr. Chair, even though we haven't got the position on board, we're really excited. As you can tell, there's a lot of activity going on right now. This is an area we are trying to step up on. Getting the three positions on board, and now that we've got the CAFR completed, we'll be able to get the stuff moving forward as well. But there's a lot of activity going on. I will tell you, we're going to run into roadblocks. We're going to have issues between transferring information back and forth, but we're actively working on it right now.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Colleagues, do you have any questions or comments? Thank you. We really appreciate you coming and sharing this with us today. All right. So, colleagues, we are right on schedule, but we still have a lot more to do today, and Paul's going to share a few thoughts with us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just wanted to note that, as was stated, the three positions were approved for the full biennium, so you're likely to see a technical adjustment in the budget reconciliation bill to adjust the DAS budget downwards to reflect how the bill is actually being implemented.
Perfect. All right. Thank you, sir. All right, so I'm going to close the informational meeting now on the Department of Administrative Services, Senate Bill 55, the Senate 55 project. And colleagues, we're now in a work session. So, John, I've opened up all of these work sessions here. We don't have a quorum yet, but Representative Frederick will be back with us. So what I was hoping we could do is go through these, and then once we grab a quorum at the end, we'll run through all of these with our votes.
And, Mr. Co-Chair, if I may clarify one thing, these are en bloc. So it's one work session, one report, but within that reporter, the agency satisfied the requirements of two budget notes.
Okay.
So that makes it a little simpler.
Oh, perfect.
A lot simpler.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. So do you want to begin with giving us an overview, and then we'll call up the Department of Revenue?
Yes. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, the DOR's Department of Revenue's primary budget bill from last session, House Bill 5035, contained two budget notes with directions around collections and cash management. The first one asked them to conduct reviews of enterprise cash management practices, debt collection and write-off practices, audit selection procedures, and report individually on each of these findings. And they were also asked to report on the metrics for current performance and recommendations for any statutory or administrative changes to increase revenue collections. The second budget note is just a follow-up report on House Bill 2550 from the 2011 session, which allows the agency to enter into agreements to recover non-tax debt owed the state or federal government. The agency is here to provide these reports. And in our analysis, there's one common thing among everything in all these reports, and that is the agency's in the midst of the core system replacement project. So they kind of have one foot in two different camps here. So they're definitely kind of reporting on their current activities. And the core system replacement project is going to have what is hoped to be a dramatic improvement to each of these individual items, which the agency is prepared to discuss.
Okay, so perfect. So as I look at the agenda here, John, do you want me to just stay in order in terms of calling these folks up? Would that be a recommendation? Or, Madam Director, would you like to come up first?
That's the way we coordinate it with the agency.
Is to stick in order.
Mr. Chair, Chris Kautz, Interim Director of the Department of Revenue. We have an order scheduled based on your Senate Bill 55 conversation that you just heard to bring a state reciprocal report first, then debt cancellation and write-off, audit selection, and finally cash management. So we're set to go in that order if that's good with you.
That would be perfect. I will follow your lead then if you'll have your staff come
you
betcha. Up.
Thank
for
you
your
very
direction.
Much.
Okay. Welcome.
Hi.
We're glad you're here. So we have 45 minutes to get through all of the information and to make sure we take our vote at the end. So you folks manage your time accordingly.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Bouchard, and I'm the administrator for the business division at the Oregon Department of Revenue. And to my side is Deanna Mack to assist with the process. And I'm going first because this report is it's not complex relative to the other three. I'm basically here to report to you that the Treasury Offset Program that the Department of Revenue has used with the Department of Treasury, of the U.S. Department of Treasury, also offered the use of a state reciprocal program. And by virtue of legislative authority in 2010, we were given the opportunity to partake in SRP, if you will. And the agency was committed to the process only after our technological changes with the implementation of Gentex. And so this process has now been implemented with rollout 2 of the Gentex process. So December of 15 and January of 16, the process is underway. In the slides and information, it talks about differences between the state income tax program relative to the state reciprocal program. And I'm not sure that you would like to get into the details of that, but I'm happy to answer questions.
So, colleagues, do we have any questions on, I believe it's slide number 3?
Yes, sir. Okay.
I think we're good.
I would.
Would you mind pulling your microphone just a
Absolutely.
Little closer?
Yes, sir.
Perfect. Thank you.
I did want to make a comment on page number 4, which is the return on investment slide. The reason I mention this is because one might ask, what does this mean for the state of Oregon? What will it mean? And I think that is going to take some time and some process to analyze that. But there are 9 states and the District of Columbia listed there. For a year, there's a compilation of $43 million. So that might be indicative of what the state of Oregon could receive from this opportunity. But time will tell. It's really relative to how many folks or businesses or people are doing work for the federal government that would produce this opportunity, so to speak. So rollout 2 included personal income tax, and that's what SRP will apply to first. Going forward, we will be determining the use of SRP with programs such as other agency accounts that can take advantage of the SRP for program rollout 3. In addition, we are continuing to look at other state payment types that could possibly affect our offset to federal non-tax, including vendor payments by other state agencies, as referenced in the prior testimony with a pilot program with the DAS and ODOT. So I'm happy to answer questions the best I can about this process. It's relatively straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Is there any questions, colleagues? Any comments? I think we're good.
Okay.
Yeah. Are you going to be taken off?
Sorry?
Are you going to be taken off or hanging around?
I'm going to stay in the building.
Perfect.
Yes.
All right. Perfect. I'm still digesting this a little bit, so I might have questions in a
minute. Oh, sure. Absolutely. Okay. I'll stay until the end.
Okay. Perfect.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, again, Deanna Mack for the record. The main difference between SRP and the vendor offset program is SRP is vendor offset between the state and the feds, and SRP, or the vendor offset that DAS testified about and I came up and talked about, is vendor offset amongst the agencies
among
within
state
the state.
Agencies.
Yes.
Right.
That's
okay.
The main difference.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so now we're on slide number 8.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Galvin. I'm the withholding and payroll tax manager at the Department of Revenue. During the 2015 session, we were asked to provide an update on our write-off and cancellation practices, which is what we're here to present. As you can see by this slide, the vast majority of the tax dollars that we collect are paid voluntarily. Providing education and assistance to people to help people comply is a very important part of what we do, because as you can see, it's very cost-effective. And to help people file and pay voluntarily, we provide outreach and make sure forms and publications are readily available and easy to understand. Voluntary compliance is the backbone of the tax system. As you can see by the graph, in fiscal year 2014, we brought in over $6.5 billion voluntarily. However, enforcement activities cannot go without recognition because of the direct and indirect improvements they have on voluntary compliance. Our collections process only affects a small portion of our taxpayers, most of whom file and pay voluntarily. During the collections process, we go through several steps, as Deanna previously testified last spring regarding our collection process. We try to contact every taxpayer in person. We only move into garnishment or other enforced collection actions if a taxpayer does not enter into a payment plan or pay the debt in full. There are a lot of exceptions to our collections process, including bankruptcy, hardship cases. The cost for us to collect the debt exceeds the amount of the debt, or the debtor is hospitalized, or just to name a few.
Yes, I guess one of my issues is you said that voluntary compliance is the core of how tax your agency works. My argument would be that if you are not rigorous and you create a class of scofflaws who may be able to stretch the definition, for example, of hardship, that will ultimately, in my opinion, be the undoing of the voluntary. I think those of us that pay our taxes on time have an expectation that there is going to be aggressive pursuit of those that don't. Otherwise, why should I bother? And I think that as you talked about hardship, how you define that, how subjective or objective you are in making those calls matters. Because if you all cease being aggressive, I think the whole thing unwinds.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, you hit the nail on the head as far as the indirect impact of our enforcement actions. That is absolutely why we have such good voluntary compliance, because we know that people talk. As far as our collection activities go, we do have to walk a fine balance because, as you know, we do need to be aggressive in order to collect the debt. But at the same time, we have to recognize that we're dealing with, you know, millions of people who have we don't choose them as debtors, and they often have very, very compelling cases. Sometimes they become permanently and totally disabled, and we can't collect from them because of the income cases.
Deanna, you know that, right? Because you and I talk all the time. We have her in our system as the DOR goddess of fixing things. I know that.
Can I get that business card?
I know that there are exigencies, and none of us want to make the case for chasing down someone who's been, God forbid, disabled in a horrible accident. Conversely, the more lax you create the category of hardship, the more incentive there is for people to capitalize on that and fail to pay taxes.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, that is very true. We do recognize that it is a fine line and it is a balance we have to walk. And in this 2015 session, the legislature passed a bill, House Bill 2089, that prevents us from collecting on certain hardship cases and just has them sit in uncollectible status for some period of time, depending on their circumstances. So we understand that there is a balance, and so that we are very diligent about what we can and cannot collect and what we believe is the most effective way to collect from folks. We do take it very seriously because we do believe that we are stewards of taxpayers' money, and that is our obligation to taxpaying citizens.
Thank you.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Would you go back to slide 9, please? I would say that is a graph of voluntary filers, who some of them pay voluntarily and some of them don't pay voluntarily, but they're all voluntary filers. What is ghastly missing from that is the non-filers. Do you have some those who you don't know about because they're not filing? So do you have some graphic, or could you make some graphic for us regarding your estimate of the non-filers?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, we're happy to talk to you about the tax gap and different components. This graph is just limited to collections.
Yes, I know.
And so that is another conversation that we have, and we have data and materials.
And with respect, you're not collecting from non-filers. So
right, we don't know what we don't know. So we are doing what we can to identify that in the tax gap. So yeah, we can get that follow up.
Please continue.
So we do move debt to private collection firms after a year of attempting to collect it, not receiving a payment. And it remains there for up to 3 years.
So let me ask a question. What does a private collection firm offer that the state of Oregon doesn't?
Mr. Co-Chair, generally the private collection agencies are better at collecting on out-of-state debt for us. We have to transcribe our warrants into judgments in other states, which can be very costly. We have to hire an attorney. We have to get them approved through the DOJ in the other state. They're a special assistant attorney general. It's very costly. And so sending them to a private collection firm, they're much better at out-of-state collections than we are.
Got it. Okay, thank you. Senator?
Again, I would wonder, do we know that you're better than they are, or do they not get an opportunity to collect in-state on time, you know, in-state and short-term debt? Certainly, they are assigned out-of-state debt and old debt, which makes it difficult for them to collect, but I'm not sure we're collecting. We're not. Could you kind of talk about apples and oranges here?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, we do also, just because the law allows us to, requires us to move a debt to a private collection firm after 1 year, doesn't mean we can't do it earlier. And we do that earlier. We don't wait always for old debt. If a debtor already has debt at a private collection firm and they get new debt, we will automatically send it to a private collection firm. It can be brand new debt. It just depends on the circumstances. But we take advantage of the use of private collection firms. We have a good, I think, good balance and good collaboration on what they're good at, what we're good at, and to make the most effective use of our collection resources to get in the most money for the general fund.
Let me ask one more question. Let's go Representative Nathan's
next.
Just a quick question then here. Who takes priority on delinquent payroll tax collection, the IRS or the Department of Revenue?
Mr. Co-Chair, priority is so that's a really complex question.
Right.
Sounds simpler than it is, but IRS and the Department of Revenue have agreements. It's the law says that the tax is delinquent at the time it's assessed,
right,
not necessarily when it's recorded in the counties. So when we get to a place where there is multiple liens recorded in a debt and there's a sale of property, for example, the IRS and the Department of Revenue says, yep, we have this chunk of money that's owed out of this to both agencies. And then we go back internally and look to whose debt was assessed first. And so it goes by date of assessment, and that's under the law for federal and state.
So then is it really important for us to be on our game?
Because,
I mean, let's think through this. Let's pretend I'm XYZ company, and I failed to do my payroll taxes for...
any tax.
Any tax. Mm-hmm. Well... and I do it for the state and the feds at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we're both starting off on the same path. At what point in time does the Department of Revenue take precedence over the IRS, or IRS over Department of Revenue, when it comes to, say, foreclosure on a property?
Mr. Chair, the priority base is based on when the debt is assessed, and that is when it becomes due. Taxpayers can self-assess debt at the date, you know, when they file the return. Say they file it on February 15th and they owe, you know, $1,000, it's assessed on February 15th, I believe. Same thing for the IRS. If they wait and file it on February 28th with the IRS, then we would be in front of the IRS. It goes, the door swings both ways.
So I really understand. I understand what I'm trying to get as a real life scenario, where they walk in and they plunk in both envelopes on January or on April 15th, but they're delinquent on both of them.
I'd have to look at the agreement on that scenario where there's a tiebreaker. I think that's dealt with in the agreement we have with the IRS, but I don't know that.
I'm just curious, but you don't operate
that
in
doesn't
parity.
Happen. I have not yet seen that very often. I've dealt with a lot of priority cases, and I've not seen that.
Okay,
I'm sure.
I wasn't sure if you foreclosed in parity, where you took a buck, they took a buck.
We don't typically. Neither one of the two agencies typically, Mr. Co-Chair, do the foreclosures. It's usually the lender that's doing the foreclosure, and we're named in the lawsuit as a recipient, and so we're a defendant because we owe debt. Owes us debt, and so we're named that way.
Makes perfect sense to me. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some time ago, I was talking to a representative of a private collection firm, and at that time, that individual represented to me that the Department of Revenue appeared to have contracts with three collection firms, mm-hmm. and presented some information that leads me to ask you this question. Have you already supplied us with, or could you supply us with, information about the effect of how you've distributed these accounts to those private firms? Like, how many accounts did you distribute? What was the value of those? And what's the effectiveness of each of those firms. And the reason I'm asking very specifically is there was an assertion that one of the Oregon firms was being very successful, yet the Department of Revenue had yet contracted for and sent a lot of business to an out-of-state firm. And I'm wondering why that would be.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Nathanson, the contract for the private collection firms is through DAS, and there are three, I believe, agencies. I can't name them off the top of my head, and we do participate through purchase order for those services. I could ask our staff to see if we could find out the characteristics of the debt that we assigned to each of those three different. I do believe we were using two of them, and we just recently started using the third one. I think this last year.
I would appreciate some additional detail and follow-up because I'm especially concerned that we make sure that we're also maximizing our ability to work with Oregon business and support Oregon business, not so much out-of-state business, when Oregon business is able to do the job, has the capacity, and is effective and demonstrating they can do the job. Thank you.
Please continue.
The statute allows a year for sending it to private collection firms to make sure that it gets through our refund offset process. And after 3 years, the debt is considered for write-off. Write-off is a standard accounting practice used by both public and private businesses to help prioritize our collectors' work. It's a way for us to take the debt that is likely uncollectible out of collections for a period of time while we wait for an asset to appear so that we can resume collections. We prioritize collectors' work by managing and monitoring accounts that aren't productive. These activities take time and resource. Write-off is a good way to ensure that we're focused on collecting what is collectible. If outstanding debt isn't likely to be collected for whatever reason, we want a way to distinguish that before moving it to the step of canceling the debt forever.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
We just had this interesting conversation. I know you guys were in the room matching current ODOT vendors against arrearages. My question is, do you keep track of the written off debt, and have we contemplated that within the context of this more aggressive collection that the state of Oregon is undertaking? Because I wouldn't want a vendor who had been discharged by an uncollected debt. I mean, they're a scofflaw. They hang out 3 years. They manage to elude you. And now they want to come back in and contract with state agencies. What happens to this list? Where is it available?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, the write-off is a temporary holding, for lack of a better term. It's kind of a bucket where we put accounts for temporarily not being collected on. And so we have a list. I mean, it's not really a list. It's data in our system. There, every account is indicated as being in write-off. And every account, if it comes back out of write-off, is indicated as being write-off reinstated. There's a report that we run. We used to be required to send it to the Secretary of State showing which debtors we put into the write-off list. Of course, it's got confidential taxpayer information on it, but we do have a report we can in our legacy system run. We used to be required to do. We do use it. It is if we get information like later from ODOT on the vendor offset that there's a contract there, presumably, I mean, we would take them out of write-off if we get indication that there would be some sort of an asset. Yeah. My guess is that they probably wouldn't be eligible for write-off because they are currently in our system, so they wouldn't go into that holding bucket in the first place.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
What's the process internal to DOR before you actually write off a debt? At what level of management does that happen? I'm going back to those dark days when you guys issued a refund and the number alone should have caused people to pay attention. I'm trying to figure out if you had a write-off that's $120,000, does somebody perk up about that?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, I think I'd have to go back and find out what the internal controls are on that process. I don't know off the top of my head. I've been a little removed from that program. I do believe that it is section manager approval, but I'd have to confirm that.
I'd very much like to know that.
Yeah. Senator Whitsitt.
I think I'm going to go back to the out-of-state collectors for a minute. I thought I heard you say that it's actually a DAS contract. The DAS lists a contract with out-of-state collectors. And I'm wondering, is DAS or the Department of Revenue or anyone else actually analyzing the performance of these whether out-of-state or in-state, a private tax collector to see whether they're just picking low-hanging fruit or whether they're actually trying to go after all of the debt assigned to them? Do you have a division that does that, or does DAS, or do you know?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I don't know if statewide if that's done. I know we look internally to see which one is the most productive, and we have a unit that's assigned to those, and I think we do have most of the accounts going to, I believe, one of them in Eugene or Springfield. But we can find out. I don't know that statewide that they do that, because it's used by all state agencies, I believe, are eligible to issue a purchase order to join into that contract for those services. I don't know if it's done statewide.
You know, just one observation as you move forward, and feel free to comment on it or not. But as I look at this and we see $7.6 million in debt written off since the beginning of 2011, that sounds like a lot of money, and it is. I'll bet you that's a drop in the bucket compared to those folks who don't accurately complete their income tax return or provide misleading information in their tax return and as a consequence pay less tax than they should. And to me it seems as if as a committee we ought to be having a conversation on the accuracy of tax returns just as much as we should be about write-offs.
Agreed. And Mr. Chair, one of our case selection, Katie Lawley, is here to talk about the way we select audits. And we have several edits in our system, for lack of a better word, that run a return through processing to check for obvious errors, check for math errors, check for things that don't make sense, flag it for audit. And she's here to talk about that in a little bit. But we do take that very seriously as well.
Perfectly. And my understanding is you have great partnerships with the Internal Revenue Service, and information is shared back and forth.
Yes, we do.
Perfect. Okay, so let's continue. We're down to 25 minutes. And John, how much time do you think you're going to need to get through your stuff to get us closed out? Five minutes? Less than 1 minute. All right. So we're going to go. We want to give 2 minutes to spare. So we're going to give you 22 more minutes.
In 2013, you gave us a policy option package aimed at reducing the accounts receivable. This chart shows the result of that work, and you can see in column 2013 where we were able to sanitize our accounts receivable by nearly $5 million. That debt was determined likely not to be collected.
Okay, so right now our legacy system, I guess one of the things I want you to take away is that write-off is not an admission of defeat. We can bring it back. We can look at it again. Currently, the system does notify us, and our legacy system notify an analyst if there is some sort of change, like in your example, that would trigger us to bring it back out and reinstate it and start actively collecting on it, a name change, an address change, check issued, anything like that.
Can you do it? I need a training 101 just most briefly. What would cause somebody to disappear? How do they disappear from us? Is it they're going to prison? I mean, how do we not find them in today's society?
Mr. Co-Chair, sometimes they just don't have income in Oregon anymore. They retire. They just don't have a presence here. They've moved out of state. They go to Mexico. I mean, I don't know where they just come and go. They get to go on vacation, permanent vacation. So we do look for them, and that's why we have LexisNexis to help us identify where people have gone.
You can go Senator Johnson and Rep. Nathan.
Mr. Chair, in my private life, I have been involved in student financial assistance, grants and loans, and we have chased some of those guys to the end of the earth, and they do just disappear.
They disappear.
We look on Facebook. We've used every trick in the book, right. And they just are gone.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. This may have already been covered, and I just missed it in your responses, but because it's so easy for computer databases to match fairly standard types of information, such as last name, first name, things like that. is the database of names or, you know, other discrete pieces of information, have you set it up to do routine periodic matches against other databases, such as people looking for a driver's license or something from employment department or something else? Are there just routine periodic? This doesn't take human work. We're telling a computer to go look at something in the background while we're doing something else.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Nathanson, we do, I think you're talking about basically a data warehouse kind of idea.
Yes.
Where all this data is stored. And we do have access to DMV records, and we do have access to employment department records, and we use them all the time in helping us find assets and people.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
That's not my question. You use those. Hmm. Are you running routine periodic matching programs so the software can find it before it occurs to you to go look? I'm not talking about looking up someone one by one to try to find them. I'm talking about a computer matching, I see a name in this database and I see a name in that database, and then alerting you, I have found a match.
And Representative Nathanson, I believe that is one of the benefits of Gentax. I know in our old system we had to look one by one, but I believe that the intent is for us to be able to do that in a more automated way through data warehouse and having more analytics available that way. That's the goal.
Good.
Okay. So as you can see, as a good segue into Gentax, we do believe that Gentax will be able to automate the write-off and reinstatement actions as we move into that, depending on what the business rules are that we adopt. There are, you know, the criteria that the system would have to go through. So we believe that the system will more efficiently move these accounts into write-off in the future. Each year we move about 20% of them back into they're reinstated back into active collections because of one of those alerts. Reinstatements don't always, you know, result in dollars collected. I just want to make sure you realize that just because it's reinstated doesn't necessarily mean that we'll actually collect the money. Since 2007, we've collected about 4% of the total debt that was initially written off, which tells us that the accounts that we're moving into write-off status actually are not very collectible. They've been moved appropriately. So cancellation, unlike write-off, it removes it permanently. It's forever extinguished, said our advice over the years. So when we get to a point of cancellation, it's gone. So we can't collect it even if we later find an account or an asset. That's the difference. People tend to use the terms interchangeably, write-off, cancellation, but they are definitely different. Write-off moves it into a temporary holding bucket. Cancellation is forever gone. So the rules, of course, for cancellation are on the slide there. But we also can cancel debt if it's not cost-effective to collect the debt. So for example, we would cancel small balances routinely. If someone, you know, has a 44-cent balance, we're not obviously going to send them a bill. We're not going to send them a refund for 44 cents. It doesn't make sense. So we have a process to deal with small balances.
So really quick, Senator Whitsitt.
Yes, on the your bar graph there, looks like roughly 3/4 of the debt that's been canceled since 2011 was canceled in the last 2 years, in 13 and 14. I guess what the question is, what is the mean age of your debt that's canceled? Are you canceling debt that was accrued in 2011, or are you canceling debt that was accrued in 1998 or whatever?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I don't know if we know the mean, but it definitely varies. It depends. Sometimes if the debt is too costly to collect, maybe we have to record a judgment in another state and it will cost us $2,000 to do that, and the person only owes us $200. It doesn't make sense to spend that money to collect that debt, so we could cancel that. And it could be more current debt if you know, 3 or 4 years old, perhaps, as opposed to something that's almost, you know, 18, 19 years old. But ideally, we'll have not debt on the books that's that old when we roll out with Gentax, because it'll automate a lot of that process and get rid of some of that very uncollectible debt and clean up the reporting for our AR. Okay, so right now we're estimating that 90% of inventory of collections should still be in collections. We do focus on the more recent debt in anticipation of the efficiencies that Gentex is going to bring us. We think that the automation of write-off and cancellation will clear up that backlog that you see on that on the next slide in particular. More than 60% of the debt, as you can see, is prior to 2007 that's on our books, and so we'd like to get that off of there if it qualifies and clean that up for you so you have better reporting numbers. In the future, we, as we've already talked about, the Gentex automation state reciprocal program that Steve Bouchard talked about a little bit ago, we're going to have better data to use, more data, and hopefully be able to do more matching. The financial institution data match, which I do believe is headed down to Ways and Means from the House Revenue Committee.
So really quick, Senator Whitsitt.
Let's go back one slide.
Back one slide. Okay.
The difference between the ratio of cancellation and write-offs is striking. If you look at
another slide, is it which
valuing the inventory?
Yes.
If you take the if you go back to the $7.6 million that was written off in between 11 and 14, and the $233 million that was canceled in the same period of time, this is a complete changeover from what do you see what I'm getting at?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I actually am not following you. I apologize.
If I understand your series of slides, mm-hmm. you said that in between 2011 and 2014, you have written off $7.6 million. During the same period of time, you canceled $233 million. Now, looking forward, you're saying that you're looking to cancel $9 million and write off $63 million as a complete shift of the paradigm.
Well, we think that the $63 million is what's eligible to be written off that we haven't yet written off. Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, if I'm following you, that's what we estimate is in our inventory currently, that is that this whole wheel here of all our debt that's eligible for write-off, not what we've actually written off.
So which you did such a good job of canceling the debt in 13 and 14 that you've only got $9 million left to cancel?
I guess, and where is it on the, I'm not following you on the canceling.
Go back.
There. This is estimates. This is all potential estimates of... Okay, and I think, is that slide 15? Okay, so this here, cancellations for the personal income tax program, I think is this because, and John, maybe you can speak to this, I think that this is the sanitizing our accounts receivable component where we had staff assigned specifically to clean up the AR.
So you have done such a good job of canceling the debt over the last two years, and now you don't have much to cancel. Okay.
Yes, fine. I think that's exactly right. I'm sorry, I wasn't following where you were going with that.
Okay. So I'm going to have to ask you to
really wrap up fast.
Here.
So the improvements, as you know, Financial Institution Data Match, House Bill 4131 is on its way to Ways and Means. That bill also includes employer new hire reporting. It allows us to access more quickly than what we get currently from Employment Department new employee information. We sent you a letter back in December, early January, I believe, indicating a pilot project that we're working on to post delinquent debtors on our website. That is underway, and one of the goals is that we're going to look at our write-off criteria to make sure that it still makes sense. Does it make sense to change it from 3 years to some other time frame or something like that? So in general, that's what we're working on. A lot of it comes out of the Secretary of State audit. A lot of it comes from Senate Bill 55. A lot of it is stuff that we've really wanted for a long time, and we really appreciate the effort at getting us the tools we need to do the job you've charged us with.
Senator Johnson.
I'm very gratified to hear that you're going to post those delinquent debtors, because that idea has come up over and over and over again, and there was an enormous amount of pushback from this building, and I'm thrilled you're doing it.
Yeah, so am I.
Ditto.
All righty. Thank you very much. So, colleagues, we're very short on time, but we need to get through two more presentations. Come on up. So I'm going to run a heavy gavel here and just give 6 minutes
for each presentation, but I want committee members to know that should you have questions, should you have anything you need to visit with our director, Chris, you'll make sure you connect with any one of us outside of the hearing. Okay. So welcome, and like I said, please give us 30,000 feet in 6 minutes.
Thank you, co-chair, members of the committee. Katie Lawley from the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'm here just to talk about the audit selection processes. That very first slide, we can skip over that. That's really just an overview. So this slide here, as you can see, the graphic basically shows our audit levels of auditors. We basically have three levels of auditors. Next, we show the complexity level of our audits, starting at the left side there with single issues, moving up into complex or multiple issue audits and businesses, and finally the most complex work being the entity audits, such as C corporations, partnerships, pass-through entities, things like that. We have a biennial resource allocation plan, which identifies the number of cases that we plan to complete based on the amount of resources available and the time it takes to complete each audit. We look at this information as we develop the plan each biennium. The goal of our case selection process is to have a fair and balanced mix of audits, including areas that are high risk to voluntary compliance, such as income that lacks third-party reporting, also complex areas of the tax law, as well as simpler audits that take less time and show a larger, that enable us to show a larger presence throughout the tax base. This is our case selection philosophy, the top driver again being to increase voluntary compliance among taxpayers. We do this by correcting taxpayer behavior and educating them through the audit process. We use, again, a fair and balanced approach to case selection. We choose cases from a wide variety of compliance issues and tax law, as well as varying the scope of audits by focusing some audit time on more straightforward or simple issues that require less time, and some of our audit time on in-depth audits that look at the entire business operations. We also use a centralized approach to select our audits. A small group of staff develop criteria that the system uses then to find the audit leads. Auditors do provide input to this group based on the results of their audits, which allows the group to refine their criteria and select audits that have a higher likelihood of being incorrect.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. We don't have time to discuss it today, but I would like a in-depth explanation of the audit procedure that was applied to the business energy tax credits and the inability of some of the auditors who wanted to expand that gold mine to do so because of direction from whether it was your director or the governor or whomever. I want to know more about that.
Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Whitsitt. We can certainly provide more information.
I'd respectfully ask that that be circulated to the full committee.
Appreciate it.
Yes.
Please do.
Okay, so again, the case selection process for our personal income tax and corporate tax programs are largely similar. However, there are differences. Because of the complexity of corporate tax laws across the country and in Oregon, and the complex structures of the businesses themselves, there is an element of manual review before an audit is assigned in the corporate tax program.
Can you push pause really quick there, back on the manual review? I'm hoping the Oregon Department of Revenue keeps when a company, a small business owner, say, goes through an audit, I'm hoping there's historical data kept to show patterns. Let me give you an example. I manage the Eastern Oregon University Small Business Development Center, and so I work with a lot of business owners. And at one time, we had an entrepreneur who there was an inquiry about a contributions to his church, okay? Mm-hmm. And in this case, he gave 10% tithe, but he gave it on his gross, not his net. Mm-hmm. And when he gave it on his gross, it turned out to be one heck of a large amount, and it sent a flag up saying, did someone really give this much money? Well, there was documentation very quickly to demonstrate that, yes, that occurred. Is that historical evidence kept? So should that flag again, you can look back and say, you know, we questioned this individual. They were able to document it and show, yes, they did
do it correctly, we're not going to contact them this time.
Right. Co-Chair Smith, that's a great question. And yes, we do, as part of our pre-audit analysis on really every audit that we open, we do look back within a reasonable period of time to see if there was a previous audit. And in that sort of case, every audit will be dependent on the facts and circumstances. But if it's the very same issue and things look about the same, it's very unlikely that an audit would be opened again.
Perfect. Thank you. So let's, I'm going to ask you to wrap up in the next 120 seconds.
So this slide just shows our audit change rate. The audit change rate is the percentage of audits that result in a change. We use this measure to make to ensure that our case selection process is choosing the best cases, again, to meet our goals of voluntary compliance. By striving for a high audit change rate, we ensure that we're using our resources wisely in an efficient manner. We also decrease the burden on compliant taxpayers. And as you can see, the change rate is mostly above the 85% mark. Moving on to the benefits of Gentax, Deanna's already mentioned some about our data warehouse, and this is our central repository for tax and other information. Previously, this information was stored in multiple areas, which meant we had to pull it all together, but now it's all in one location, which makes it easier for us to use for case selection. Discovery is the part of Gentax that performs case selection. This is where those criteria are run through the data, and it creates the leads for the auditors. The scoring system allows us to prioritize audit leads based on the highest risk to voluntary compliance. The benefit of Gentax is that we can now prioritize all audits instead of just one type of audit at a time. And finally, the built-in reporting system will allow us to see reports on data that we were unable to on our old system. For example, actual dollars paid compared to what we bill from audit activity, appeal rates, or better case, individual case tracking. Again, the future really is that the benefits for case selection will come as we build up data in the system. Right now, that's just starting as the personal income tax program has just come into Gentax. With more flexibility in reporting, we'll be able to look towards new metrics and to help us select better cases for audit. And with the new tools that we've been provided in the system, with more information, but our basic philosophy behind voluntary compliance, fairness, and balance will still drive all of those choices.
Thank you so much for your presentation. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And colleagues, I would encourage you, if you do have additional questions, just to get a hold of you folks directly.
Great. Thank you.
All right, so Madam Director, whether this is good or bad, I'm holding you to 3.5 minutes. And colleagues, I would share with you again, if anyone has additional questions outside of our committee, please get a hold of the director directly.
Yeah. Chair Smith, Chris Couts from the Department of Revenue. We have practiced to be at the couple of minute mark here with this last presentation. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jolene.
Perfect. Welcome.
Chair Smith and members of the committee, Jolene Smith, for the record, I am the Processing Center Section Manager. Sorry. And I'm here today to follow up about the detailed review of our enterprise cash management practices. If it is appropriate at this time, I'd like to take a minute just to circle back and regarding my testimony given last week regarding the marijuana implementation. I walked away feeling like I fell short in giving you confidence in a couple of my answers. And if you felt uneasy or seemed vague, my intent was absolutely not to do that. I did not want to come across rude or instill a lack of confidence. And if you would like, I can follow up with the two issues that I fell short with, which was contaminated cash and the armored car.
So I would ask for you just to briefly share on that, because
sure.
I want to share something. There's a little bit of sensitivity that we have to recognize in the management of this issue. And I think it's very appropriate for us to gather information, but at the same time, we need to recognize that the Department of Revenue is working through conversations, and at probably a future time, we're going to ask for more information as you work through that. So if you could give us a brief overview,
yes.
But at the same time, we need to recognize there are some sensitivities you're working through.
Yeah. Okay.
That'd be very helpful.
The question around contaminated currency was whether it was a negotiated or a subjective cost. There has been no specific conversations around or discussed around a negotiated cost. This is simply an assumption from the program standpoint that we factored in, desiring that if the cash contamination does get through our agency into the financial institution that we will have the funds sitting there to pay for it. It is nothing that we have negotiated. And there, we do have the ability to reject cash. However, we have not created a hard and fast policy around that. And our current cash management leadership feels that the cash would have to be pretty bad to reject it. And they're not planning for that to happen. And in the beginning, they will just review those transactions on a case-by-case scenario.
Mr. Chair, really quickly.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair.
I think, first of all, thank you for what you said to us at the beginning and for being willing to go back and reassure us, because we were all a little confused last Wednesday. but I want to be clear. Tell us exactly what the term contaminated cash means, because there was a lot of confusion about that last week.
And I have that.
Excellent. Right. Thank you very much.
So contaminated cash, the definition of it is it's coin or currency that has been damaged by or exposed to contaminants that possess a health risk, hazard, or safety risk. So an example of that would be like prolonged exposure to water or liquids, blood, urine, feces, things like that. That is contaminated cash. If you're thinking about like the smell, we would not reject something based on a smell. We could, but we probably wouldn't. This is kind of a new environment for us, and so that's how we would define the contaminated currency at this point.
Perfect.
Thank you.
So do you have a final thought for us today?
Yes. The other area that I want to just touch on is the armored car service. I felt I could have done a better job and came across a little less guarded about it. Your question was, do you have an armored car car contract to accept these funds? Yes, we do have a current armored car service, and we are working with DASH, the Treasurer's Office, and Department of Justice on a prudent contingency plan. Again, my apologies. And I can answer any other questions you have, but that was not my intentions when I left here last Wednesday.
Senator Johnson.
I thank you for your candor and coming back and doing what you've just done. I think, Mr. Chair, that this underscores the need for coordination among agencies. I think we're going to be dealing in marijuana land for the next decade. And it appears to me as though we are like a box of mice that somebody has tipped over. We've got agencies doing little pockets of this, that, and the other thing. Nobody knows how candidly they can talk about this, that, or the other thing. And it's making a difficult situation more difficult. And people that are testifying, I think, should be coached by somebody somewhere. There are sensitivities. I get that. There are things we don't want to disclose for confidentiality or safety reasons of the personnel handling all this stuff. But we got to get our act together. And we just see money pouring out the door. I just stepped out to hear another request from OLCC about more money. And I think we've got to get a handle on this and get it quickly. And if I were queen, whoever this person is would carry the card to the governor for full convening authority. But we got to get our arms around this quickly.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Chair, Senators, thank you.
Yeah.
So in respect of time, I will give a quick update or go over this very quickly. And if you have any questions or follow-up, I'd be really happy to answer it. There are just a few points that I want to make sure that you take away from this. The information in these slide decks focuses on our three largest programs. Please remember that we administer over 40 or close to 40 tax programs, but we're really focused on three in here. We are in the midst of significant changes, which Deanna had talked about earlier. It will totally impact our analysis, our process, our reporting, the implementation of not only the core system replacement, but our processing lifecycle project that we are currently in the midst of as well. We acknowledge that there's area of improvements in processing times and efficiencies. One area that comes up a lot is the timeline around season and our backlog that happens there. Very aware of it, and it's something that we are focused on with these two projects to get better information and control of. In the next 3 to 5 years, you should see less manual processes out of us, stable data, and performance measures that we can stand behind.
Appreciate it. I'm going to cut you off there.
Perfect.
Thank you very much, Madam Director. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John, share with us any final thoughts.
So the LFO recommendation is just to acknowledge receipt of the agency's report.
Mr. Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of the agency's report.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair moves that we acknowledge receipt of the agency's report, and it's been a busy day. Is there any comments
on this? Any thoughts, any objections to this? Seeing no objections, we're going to acknowledge receipt of the report. Colleagues, thank you very much for allowing us to maintain such a heavy-handed agenda, I guess. I need a carrier. Who would be willing to carry this to full Ways and Means for me?
I'll take it if you want me to, Mr. Chair.
All right. Madam Co-Chair will be the carrier on this. John, anything else?
One minor thing. The agency has written down their responses to the subcommittee's questions from Monday, and they've been posted out on OLIS, and there are a few other questions that are not the agency's responsibility. We're continuing to follow up on.
Director, you're assuring us that if any of us have questions, we can get a hold of you, and you'll come visit us at our office.
Yes, Mr. Chair, anytime.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. Julie, anything else we need to think about? We're good? All right, colleagues, we're going to adjourn for the day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
To adjourn for the day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.